The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Keep your mission on your mind, and your mind on your mission. This is Mission Minded with Michael Coleman.
Time to get your mission on your mind. It is Mission Minded, 10 o'clock every Monday through Friday morning, 10 o'clock Central Time right here on the TKR app. He is Michael Coleman. He is the CEO of the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. They cover 35 counties in the great state of Alabama. We have a special show that just talks about the Heart of Alabama Food Bank called Bite by Bite, which you can also hear on Tony Curry Radio. But this show not only talks about food banking, but also talks about business in general. Michael, first of all, how you doing, brother? You doing good?
Yep. Always look forward to spending time with you.
Yes,
and I'm really interested to get to our emails today and talk about our topic for the day. So I'm doing great.
Yeah, this is good. The dark side of influence, understanding the power of request, the Milgram experiment. I'm thinking, ooh, this sounds kind of creepy, especially when you use the word dark side. So I was kind of excited. It's about people pleasing. We'll talk about that on the latter side of this, but we do have some emails, info@tonycurryradio.net. We read just about every email that comes in here. Rhonda in Hueytown wants to know, how has the grain and transport issue associated with the Russian war impact affected food banking? It's a great question. And I guess it does indirectly, directly affect you.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, it absolutely affects us, because when you're talking about grain, and they export a lot of the world's grain from Ukraine, and that's something I had no idea. When Russia shut down the ports in Crimea, took control of that territory, and then the war broke out, it absolutely affected exports. And you know, everything is global. Everything's tied into everything else. And so maybe 30 years ago, you could have a cut in the supply chain like that, and it may affect Asia, may affect, you know, Europe. But now everything is so intertwined. And so, yes, it absolutely affects those who use grains for bread making and all the other kind of things. They can't get the grain. They can't produce the food. And ultimately, it dwindles its way through the food supply, just like if there was a transportation disruption, shipping, if there's a famine or there's droughts, all that affects the supply chain. And when the supply chain is affected, there's less food, it's more costly, and it just presents us with some new challenges. And so that's certainly been the case.
We saw that big time during COVID. And I know that directly affected you when you were working in the food banking industry. And of course, a little after that as well, because some of that food chain supply stuff never came back. And I remember, you know, for a long time, you couldn't get steak. You couldn't get baby back ribs. Not to say that I'd eat baby back ribs 7 days a week. I would if I could afford it. But you couldn't get cuts of meat. And people were buying, I remember people buying freezers so they could deep freeze. And, you know, we are such a knee-jerk society. How long does it take? I know when they talk about raising the oil of gas, or perhaps they have oil embargoes where some of these countries will stop producing oil. And I know it's going to affect us. We hear the news, but usually it takes 30, 45, 60 days before it actually starts directly affecting our pocketbooks. How's it work in the food business?
Yeah, it's it depends on what level of disruption. It depends on how much is surplus. And right now, there's just not tons of surplus. And so even small inconveniences or disruptions in the transportation business, again, shipping, all that kind of stuff ends up having a pretty good impact, because it takes a while. Not only to, you know, the disruption starts, then you work through all your cycles. Well, then where you're expecting that backflow to come in, that's where it really starts hitting you. And like you said, sometimes it takes a couple months. It's always been funny to me is when some tragedy happens and they think there's going to be a disruption of oil. I go out the very next morning and my gas is 20 cents more a gallon. But yet when they say there's a glut of oil and prices are going to come down, it doesn't happen overnight. It usually takes, you know, several weeks for it to work through the system. But I mean, if you think about it, if we purchase oil, if a tanker comes in, goes to a refinery, it makes it all the way through their system and all the parts, how the petroleum's broken out and then distributed through the, I mean, it takes weeks to, for all that to happen. And so, the food business and the commodities there that affect the food business are really no different than your oil and everything else. It's very similar.
All right. Info at TonyCurryRadio.net. This is Mission Minded, 10 o'clock Central. Order that Tony Curry Radio app. It's TKR on both Android and Apple. Super easy to get. And wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, we're available in every major industry. Here's a good one here from Sherry in Milwaukee. She says she works for a software company. She's a human resource editor up there in Milwaukee. They have 36 people in their office. She said her boss came up with a bright idea that, of course, in quotes, saying that he wants to get every individual in the office to get to talk to each other more. So what he's done is he's instructed her to find someone she's never spoken to in her office, and that's the person she needs to be linked up. She's responsible for getting, what, 18 pairs of people together to get to talk to each other and at least converse, find out more about each other, find more personal information. She said, it sounds like an absolute train wreck. Is this a good idea? And has Michael ever heard of this idea before? What is that?
Well, I will tell you, it's very common when you're doing organizational type training, leadership training, because people work in silos and you have all sorts of different people. Like I'm very extroverted, and you have people who are introverts who just want to go to their office. They want to be left alone. And then sometimes it's hard to feel like to make somebody who's introverted feel part of the organization, because they tend to not want to talk to others, build relationships as much. And so I think it sounds like that the boss has the right heart. I'm not sure, depending on each company, you have to determine what's the best approach to that. Now, putting two people together, I mean, if this was part of some bigger plan, you might could understand it, but putting two people together, especially two introverts, and then saying you need to reveal, get to know each other, reveal personal information, whatever. Yeah, you have to be just very careful about that.
Can you say no as an employee? Can you say no, I'm not doing this? Because this doesn't seem like something you'd want to see at a software company. I'm just saying.
I know I'm going off of stereotypes, but you would think most people in software companies are computer guys and gals and who are not social people. They just want to sit at their computer and write programs and do software, play games and all that. I mean, devise games and all that. So I understand probably the sentiment. Hey, we need to bond. I don't know. Like I said, every company is different. I have seen companies say, we're going to go out and do an activity together. Or we're going to go out and bowl together. And then what tends to happen is, from my experience, rather than having a forced relationship, it's when you're out there and you're bowling or you're doing something like that, where you're doing an activity. The activity, you hope that you'd start to develop relationships, but it's not just sitting two people down across from the table and say, all right, form a relationship.
Seems like speed dating at the workplace.
Most fun I've ever had was we took our organization, split it in half, and went to those problem-solving rooms and competed against each other, where you have to rely on each other to find clues and solve a puzzle, and you're trying to beat the other team. And so it was a little bit of competition in there, but you're forced to kind of work together. I have found that those kind of activities are a lot better than just the idea of sitting two people down at a table and saying, okay, develop a relationship.
You can actually find the Tony Curry Radio escape room down in Baton Rouge. They actually did. I actually did the voice work for one of these escape rooms where they actually get caught inside a radio station. They have to get out of a radio station, which is
that's awesome. That's
exactly how I left radio and started my own thing here. Info at TonyCurryRadio.net. One more email here. We got a couple more, but we'll do one more here. Nina in Oak Grove says they have food drives all the time at their church. And what ends up happening is everyone buys the cheapest thing they can find so they can come show up with 15, 16 bags of groceries. She said, are there foods that the food bank does not use? Are there foods that do serve no purpose? And she's like, what are some of the items that you desperately need that aren't so expensive that you really go through a lot of? And she also wanted to know the difference between non-perishable and perishable goods. There's a lot there. I know peanut butter's big, right?
Yeah, shelf-stable items that have a lot of life. You know, one of the biggest challenges that we have is where people see the best buy date or the best if purchased by, and they have convinced themselves that that's an expiration date. And the USD, and really what the manufacturer is saying is, it's not that the food expires, is that it's guaranteed, in essence, to be the best quality it can absolutely be. So it's going to be the freshest. You're not going to even risk losing any freshness or color or anything to the product if you purchase it by this date. But, you know, like my wife, I may have said it before, my wife is the kind that goes in the refrigerator. It could be 12, 10 at night. And if it's the 7th, if it just rolled around to the 7th and she said the milk expired on the 6th, she pours it out because she said, oh, no, this milk is bad. The reality is the USDA gives us all sorts of guidelines. And on most canned food, you can go up to 18 months past that and still have very safe, same nutrition food. So we battle this all the time in terms of helping people understand.
So why don't they change that date?
Well, if you go
18 months past, like on green beans, I know if you go to a Y2K shelter 23 years ago, there's probably stuff still in the shelter that's good to this day.
Yeah, and they're not even 100% saying that it's guaranteed to not be bad. What they do is, like with peanut butter, I think they extended it 2, maybe 3 years. I'd have to check the latest past the best by date.
Yeah,
and that's a lot of food banking, is we capture this food and give it out to people. But sometimes we find that people go, oh, well, you're trying to give me expired food. And they are insulted by that, challenged by it. But to answer her question specifically, shelf-stable food, canned goods are always something that's good. But one of the things we try to tell our people is that, look, we can get 5 meals, and that's 1.2 pounds per meal, 5 meals per dollar. Wow. Through our donation chain channels, through what we purchase. However, there are so many people who go, well, no, I could give you a dollar and you could get more, but there's something about handing you a can of peas or handing you a jar of peanut butter, and we get that. There's a psychological thing. So it's more advantageous for us to get the dollars and purchase the food. It can go so much further. But there's nothing in terms of what you can buy off the shelf that a typical food bank can't use. Now, that's not always the case with food pantries, but if you're doing it at a food bank, every food bank should be prepared, whether it's protein, whether it's frozen, whether it's dry, whether it's canned, no matter what it is, a food bank should be able to take that and utilize that for people in need.
And I've seen your facility at the Heart of Alabama Food Bank, and I've seen just the facility you have. And again, you're talking frozen, you're talking meat, you're talking anything that is given. You'll get the most shelf life out of it in order to pass it on. So that's good stuff here. Michael Coleman joins us here every single week, Mission Minded, 10 o'clock in the morning, every Monday through Friday morning, 10 o'clock Central, right here on TKR, wherever you get your favorite podcast. Let's get into our topic here, the dark side of influence, understanding the power of request, the Milgram experiment. Briefly explain what this is first before we talk about the nuts and bolts.
Yeah, so I had heard of this. I didn't know it as it's either Milgram or Milgram experiment. But there was this Yale professor back in the 60s, Stanley Milgram, and he was really trying to understand and study why ordinary people do the things like follow the instructions of other people, especially people in authority, even if it means doing something that may conflict with their own moral foundation. And so what he did was, and I may not be describing this perfectly, but, you know, here's a man in a lab coat. And so he looks like somebody who's a medical authority, and he go and they had volunteers, and the volunteers agreed to put something around their fingers or their wrists and be asked questions. And every time they missed, they would be given a mild shock. And then they had another volunteer on the other side who was giving the shock. And so as they asked more and more questions and the person misses questions, they continued to increase the shock level. Mm. And what they found out was through all this was that way more people will answer yes to your question for help or to do something, even if it sometimes conflicts with their moral foundation. And so when you just take that information and you bring that over into today's time, there's lots of ramifications that can come out of that. So if you look at it from the perspective of somebody who is doing the asking, and you're in a business or nonprofit, especially if you're a nonprofit fundraising, I know it can be very difficult sometimes. You're like, oh, I could go ask this person, but they probably don't want to support. They probably don't want to donate, or this person probably doesn't want to volunteer. And lots of times I know people who just will talk themselves out of the ask.
Yeah.
Business leaders who are trying to spread their product, even though it may be an effective product, we convince ourselves that, well, I don't want to ask this person because they won't. They're not as likely to give or not as likely to want to participate or take my product. And what this showed was, is that even when you're asking people to do bad things, way more people are open than are not.
Yeah.
And so what you see is the dark side of this is from the asker's perspective is if you know you can get a lot more people to do what you want to do, well, then that means you've got a certain amount of ability, you've got a certain amount of influence, you've got a certain amount of power, and people can actually use that for nefarious things. And sometimes not necessarily intended nefarious, but you can end up abusing people at work, because if you need people to stay late, volunteer to stay late, there's lots of people who will say, yes, I'll do it because they want to be a team player. They want to be a support. They just want to be, because we generally want to please others. We generally want to help and be part of the solution. And there are people who will inevitably take advantage of that. And again, that's what some of that experiment revealed about human nature and helping us understand some of those lessons.
You know, it's interesting. And my first question would be, is there a difference between this Milgram experiment for non-for-profits as opposed to for-profit businesses? Because I see that, hey, we're a team here. We need you to, you know, we need you to be down at this live remote all weekend long because it's good for the radio station, blah, 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 as opposed to something where you're actually pulling on the heartstrings. Hey, listen, this family's not going to eat tonight unless you work late on Sunday, that kind of thing. The other thing I think is really interesting, and I didn't even think about the vitriol or the nasty side of this where people actually take advantage of people, but there are so many people that, if they're not asked to give or help, they won't do it. And it's not to say they're bad people. There's a lot of people that won't honor that, and they just won't volunteer. But boy, when they are asked and they've got a good reason to give to your non-for-profit or your business, they're more than happy to do that. Can you kind of explain that part? Sometimes it's just in the asking that creates that engagement.
Yeah, because I think, I just look at myself. I'm asked to do things at church, or I'm asked to do something at work, or I'm asked to do something just as, my Rotary Club or just whatever. And I don't think I'm much different than anybody else. I want to be a yes person where I can. I want to help. I want to make the organizations that I'm part of better. And if I have anything to offer, I certainly want to do it. So I have a desire to want to help. And what this research was showing was, is that we may think, if you don't deal with people a lot, you may think, well, Michael would really be the exception rather than the rule. But what they found out is there's way more people out there that are willing to help, but are not going to necessarily bridge that gap on their own without being asked. I mean, one of the professors that was familiar with the study furthered it by going out and saying, hey, even if you're asking people to do things like unethical things, more people would do them than you might otherwise think. And so she tested with some other things. She'd have volunteers ask strangers to fill out a survey or try to just raise money. And she said the results were always the same, that every time they had underestimated a group of people's willingness to participate or do what they were being asked to do. And so it's really amazing, because then you say, okay, well, if people tend to be more agreeable, then really what's missing is the ask. And so a lot of people don't get, because they don't ask. A lot of businesses don't market effectively. A lot of people are almost like, well, I don't want to bother this person, bother that person. A lot of people just can't stand the no, or, hey, this isn't for me. And so they'll talk themselves into all this before they even step forward. And I'll just tell you from my own self, I've never been super comfortable. I mean, I'm way more comfortable than I used to be when I first started the nonprofit world, asking people for money, because I would say to myself, listen, people who are friends, who know about what we're doing, you know, they're raising children, they're paying for private school, they donate to their church, you know, they save up what they have to go on vacation. Who am I to come along and ask them to give up their money? And so lots of times I would talk myself out of it, like, I don't want to put that burden on somebody else. But I've since learned that the reality is that there's so many people willing to do it who, you know, and I just came to understand, let them figure out what they can do, what they can do, what they're willing to do, what they're not willing to do. I ask the question, I present it. If they tell me no, I don't take it personally. I get it. Everybody's different. But I want to present them with that opportunity. And so I've moved past the hesitancy to ask for support, especially if I'm involved with something that I feel like is affecting people's lives.
Michael Coleman, the heart of Alabama Food Bank, joined us every single week here on Mission Minded, and info@TonyCurryRadio.net with your email questions. Feel free to send those to us, info@TonyCurryRadio.net. You can hear the show 10 o'clock at least 5 days a week on the TKR app and wherever you get your podcasts. Let's be really honest here. There's the givers and takers. The people that give do realize it's biblical. It's in the scripture that, when you give, you will receive. And that's just the way it is. And I have seen it's amazing, because the givers will give till it hurts. And the takers will take till it hurts as well. And for the most part, you know, I think where it gets a little messy, at least for me, is when you are a giver. Everyone knows you're a giver, and you're usually the first person that everyone goes to when there's a lot of people that can give at the same time, and it's not going to hurt them nearly as much. And the other thing is, and I think it's fair to say, we don't know what people give. You know, we think just because you're a millionaire, you know, certainly I know some frugal individuals, some people that don't give a whole lot, or at least I don't think it, but that's not for me to make that call on. So, there's billionaires out there that give away billions of dollars. We just don't know about it. We're also taught to give without, you know, having accolades for that. So, you know, I think that's a very interesting point that you bring up.
Well, I think it can be so unhealthy. I have been guilty of this in my desire to want to help, is almost not establish any personal boundaries, because I'm thinking, well, yeah, I literally have the time, but if I spend all available time doing things for other people, while those in and of themselves are good, they end up hurting me. And I've learned over time the importance of having some downtime, having some time away to recharge, to get perspective. But it can be very challenging when somebody calls upon you and asks you to do something, especially somebody that maybe a friend, to say, look, I'm sorry, I'm just not available. I just can't do it. And you and I were talking about this a little bit, you know, even to the point that, you know, I get bombarded every day with solicitations on my email. I'm sure it's people just like everybody else trying to do sales, trying to make a living. And so I spent a lot of time going, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just not interested right now in the product, or it's not a good time. And they would reply back, well, are you sure you've seen this? No, I don't think, you know, I'd sometimes go back three or four times with an email. And I just now, if people are just randomly, like, it's almost like a cold call, but just through email, you know, I just move them to my junk folder and I move on.
Yeah.
And they come back and they say, hey, just making sure you got my email. And look, I don't get mad at them. They're trying to make a living. Like I said, trying to feed their families, everything else. But I just had to make up my mind that, look, I don't owe somebody my time just because they're emailing me. I don't owe somebody my time just because they're calling or texting or, you know, trying to get on my calendar to meet with me. I have to really sit back and ask myself, you know, is this worth my time? You know, everybody's time is valuable. Now, of course, I'm not talking about things that are relevant to my job. Those things have to be done. You have to make time for that. But I'm talking about all this extraneous stuff that's out there that sucks up. Oh, it's so much.
Can you talk about it? This is really interesting because I went, I had to go to a tire shop this morning and get some tires for my son. And I'm sitting there at 7:30 this morning and there's a woman that comes in the room and she's there to get some tires put on her car and not even a good morning, hello. She said, you know, if you ever want a good massage, you know, I do massage therapy. I work right up here down the street and she's telling me the directions. And I'm thinking of all places to hit a guy up for a massage, there's a tire place at 7:30 in the morning. And I actually said, well, yeah, give me your phone number. And if that ever happens, of course I get the Woodhouse Day Spa here. So I don't need that. But I was like, but I could not believe, and she was probably in her 60s. I couldn't believe she actually just, it just came out of nowhere. And I thought, read your room. I can imagine her walking into a McDonald's, you know, and in the drive-thru or whatever and saying, hey, by the way, if you ever need a massage, here's my business card. I thought there would have been different ways for her to maybe corral the business. She could have given me a card for 10% off or something like that to perhaps get me to try it. Could you just talk about reading your room? Because when you do have an ask, and that's what these charity events are. When you fill up the club with 300 donors there, whether it be for the UAB Scholarship Fund or whether it be the, you know, Heart of Alabama Food Bank or whatever, that's what those people are there for. They're there to be to entertain and to give money to create cash flow for a particular, just talk about reading your room. And when you're, you know, listen, there's always that situation where you have a conversation with a guy in the subway and next thing you know, he's making a $10,000 donation. I get it. It happens,
but normally
it does not. Just talk about that. Just, right. a little, just talk room. About that. Just reading your room a little bit.
Yeah. So I'll give you a great example. We were contacted by this company, Vintage Wine Estates, and, they like to, sell wine at their wine tastings, and they come through, and what they try to do is they advertise that for every case of wine they donate $5 of that case price to the local food bank. And, you know, for us, that's 25 meals. So, you know, the marketing piece is, you know, for every $25, I mean, for every case sold, you're going to provide 25 meals. And I get they are using somewhat some of our community cachet, if you will. And I'm okay with that because, you know, I'm fine helping them because they're promoting us. But so we had three wine tastings just last week, and it got me in front of a group who did not know about the food bank. So one of those groups was vendors. And so I got in there and it was about, you know, about 10 minutes. And I really, boom, I'm just trying to tell them everything I could about food banking, how much I appreciate them, how much we need help. That was great. But that night, I didn't go to that function. I had a staff member and she said she was asked to stand up and look around the room. And everybody was kind of treating it not as a wine tasting, but more as like at each table, they just kept talking. They weren't even listening to anybody. And so she recognized, hey, I want to tell you what we're doing for those who may be listening. But that was not a time to really go around to each table and say, hey, would you make a donation to the Montgomery Food Bank?
Yeah.
You know, so that was very much a read the room situation. And yeah, and it's something that's very valuable because you may own, there's key people, there's key donors, or there's a key salesperson, or there's a key vendor, whatever it is. You may only get in front of them one or two times. And if you come in a really awkward time thinking, well, just everybody I'm going to ask, I'm not going to really use my judgment. This is not really the time or place, but this is, and you just go over there and grab them right in a busy time and jam your card in there and say, hey, you, I sell this. You really need to come. Boy, I'm telling you, you're very likely going to blow that opportunity. So the point you make is so true and very important for us to remember is that, you know, people say yes, so we shouldn't be afraid, but we should look for the right time and the right environment to where we have their ear and they're not distracted by other things.
If you're a cold call kind of person, and I just know this from experience because I had a foundation for a while and I've worked with you for a long period of time, and I'm so grateful to do that with you. But if you ask somebody what they do for a living, and they explain to you what they do for a living, and they're nice enough to ask you what you do for a living, and you do work for a non-for-profit, the door has just opened, my friend. And you'll read them real quick on whether they actually care about what you do for, oh, I work for the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. I'm glad you asked, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they'll usually, and if they're good listeners, they'll follow up with a couple questions and your foot is in the door. And then, you know, it may not happen ever. You know, sales are 5 to 7 calls, man. You just mentioned it earlier. You know, you may have people hitting you 3 or 4 times. They probably haven't hit you hard enough. I'm not saying to email Michael Coleman or call him again, but what I'm saying is it usually takes 5 to 7 times before you can finally close a deal. And even then, and I've actually had situations where people have said no to me after 5 phone calls, and then a year later they're reaching out to me, and I'm like, okay. So you never know. Hey Michael, great stuff. Don't forget, we do our show Mission Minded every single week right here on Tony Curry Radio, and also you can hear their brand new show called Bite by Bite. It is a little bite of information. It's about 10 to 15 minutes long. It's specifically about the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. And of course, you can go check out their website, HAFB.org, for all the information on both our shows. And to keep those emails coming, info@TonyCurryRadio.net, info@TonyCurryRadio.net. Michael, thank you so much. We'll catch up next week.
Enjoyed it as always, brother.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.